5:38 hourly.
The news cycle moves faster than ever these days, and
we're launching 5:38
hourly.
The hourly. Hello and welcome to the 5:38 Politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and we've got a big week ahead of us with impeachment hearings and a Democratic debate. We're going to have a lot of podcasts for you this week, many of those to do with the hearings. So we're going to check in briefly on impeachment polling and then move on to some other topics. And those topics include the state of the Democratic primary in Iowa. The latest Des Moines Register poll came out this weekend, and it shows Pete Buttigieg with a healthy lead over Warren, Biden, and Sanders there. We're also going to pick up on a theme from our conversation last week and ask why someone's level of education is so important in determining how they will vote. And here with me to do that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
Good, Galen. How are you?
I'm good. It's a Monday morning. I'm ready to go.
Monday, long week ahead.
It's been a while since Nate has been on.
I was on last week.
Dude. Oh, yeah, with the other Nate.
Oh, I wasn't on, right. Yeah.
Also here with us, as you just heard, is Managing Editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
Very good.
Happy Monday.
Thank you.
And joining us from the great state of Texas is our politics editor, Sarah Frostenson. How's it going, Sarah?
Good. Happy to be here.
Awesome. Happy to have you. So let's begin with where public opinion stands on the possible impeachment of President Trump. Nate, have we gotten any significant new data since the hearings began? Can we tell if they're changing public opinion already?
There have been a few polls. There was one from YouGov, a couple from Ipsos, and they do not suggest particularly big changes. In fact, overall, support for impeachment's been quite flat for several weeks now since the kind of first flurry of accusations came out. There is some evidence that people who are watching the hearings are more inclined to support impeachment, which would be a favorable fact for Democrats. However, it's also one of these things where, like, probably a lot more Democrats are watching the hearings than Republicans from what we can infer. So if you were looking for, like, big dramatic shifts based on testimony starting, not much evidence of it yet. I would say, like, it's not quite enough polling to say definitely not, but there are not many signs yet of movement.
And when would you say that we will have a more full picture of how public opinion looks, say, a week or so into these hearings?
I mean, give another week. I'm sure a lot of pollsters are interested in polling about impeachment, about probably want to get a pre-Thanksgiving read on the Democratic primary. So it wouldn't surprise me if you see, like, a lot of big national polls in the field this week, because they probably won't be in the field next week for Thanksgiving. And so I think by the end of this week or by next week's podcast, we'll have a better sense.
And it'll also be somewhat complicated, right? Because while they're in the field, we're going to be hearing from some of the key witnesses in all of this.
I would, yeah. I think we need to be patient in seeing how and whether the hearings affect public opinion, both because of what Nate says, and with any event, it takes time for that event to be reflected in polls. But also, as Amelia has said on this podcast and written for the site, these hearings tend to affect public opinion in the aggregate more than any specific moment. So I just think it'll take a bit. Also, like, remember, the entire country isn't watching the hearings themselves. Some are watching, some are hearing about it on local news. So I think we just have to wait for all that to play out.
So just to lay some markers down at the beginning of this process, Sarah, can you give us a little bit of a picture of what public opinion looks like at the start of all of this?
Yeah. So going into the first hearing last Wednesday, both Laura and Nathaniel for the site looked at where impeachment stood on a variety of different types of questions. So support for holding an inquiry, support for impeachment itself, and support for impeachment and removal. And this won't surprise you, but, like, the one that's the most popular is holding an inquiry. And then impeachment and impeachment and removal are significantly less popular at around, like, 47% or 48%, whereas support for an inquiry is at 51%. And the big trend we took away from that piece is that things have kind of started to level off. Like, you saw that big spike in early September when news of the Ukraine scandal was first breaking, but now it's tapering a bit. And I'm excited we're going to be partnering with Ipsos on another panel study that looks at how Americans' views of impeachment change throughout the inquiry. As Micah said, you know, to Amelia's point, that these hearings are cumulative, so we'll be interested to check back in with the same participants to see if their views are changing.
One other kind of technical thing to keep in mind is that, as Sarah said and as our pieces have said, there are differences based on the questions that are asked about impeachment. So when people asked, hey, should we start the impeachment process, that tended to poll better than should Trump be impeached. Pollsters, for the most part, are no longer asking the begin of the process question because the process began. And so therefore, you're not getting those numbers as often with like the big like 10-point support, don't support. You're getting the usually much closer polls about impeachment itself, about the actual act of impeachment and removal.
And I know it's going to take some time, as we've already mentioned, and that it will be the cumulative effect in general, or at least that's what history tells us, if public opinion is going to change. But I mean, from a starting point, do we have reason to believe that from here, public opinion could still shift significantly? Or are partisan opinions so set in stone that even if, say, Sondland on Wednesday gives damning testimony, that people are still pretty much stuck where they are?
I think both.
There
are a big chunk of the country is set in their ways. Polling shows that, right? They have kind of made up their mind. But I still think much of the coverage and much of the commentary underrates the number of persuadable and swingable voters there are with regards to impeachment. We don't have the exact numbers yet, so I can't cite a number. But I think one thing we're looking for in that polling Sarah mentioned with Ipsos is how firm people are in their beliefs about impeachment. So, okay, you oppose impeachment. Are you certain about that? Are you somewhat certain about that, right? I guess what I'd say is there are enough swingable voters out there, whether they move more towards impeaching and removing Trump or against, to have a big and material impact on how Senate Republicans evaluate what they should do and on 2020. The reason I say it that way is it's not a ton of people overall in the country. It's not like 50% of the country is swingable on this. But if it's like, I don't know, I'm ballparking, like if 10% of the country is still swingable on impeachment, well, that's the difference between Trump having a bad approval rating, but not so bad that he can't win re-election, and being a real significant underdog for re-election, right?
Sure. I mean, you know, in some ways, the most important number of all might be Trump's approval rating, because there are forces pushing it in either direction. On the one hand, a lot of bad new conduct is being revealed. On the other hand, if there is a backlash to impeachment, that could help Trump, right? And so far, his approval rating has steadied at about 41%, which is a little bit down from 42% kind of pre-Ukraine/impeachment, which on the one hand is not that big a shift. On the other hand, 42 is not that high to begin with, and so losing a point is not great news for Trump exactly. But, you know, I tend to be like, you know, kind of early on, if this story broke, I'm like, yeah, things are moving quickly and it's a little hard to predict. It does feel like Republicans have been able to kind of rationalize that, okay, all this conduct occurred and it's not that bad, right? Because a lot of the details that were debated initially have kind of been revealed and kind of admitted to, and it's a little hard to know. I don't know. I mean, I think Sondland is a key.
Sondland will be really interesting.
Is a key witness.
Yeah. Tune in Wednesday, folks. But also, to the point of whether or not Democrats would face a political backlash, the number that you just mentioned about Trump's approval rating shows that they haven't. Like, I think a lot of the conversation about impeachment up until Ukraine broke was, well, if Democrats go down this path, there's likely to be a political backlash. And at this point in the process, we can say there has not been a political backlash, right?
Not so far. And it's sort of hard to imagine what would happen to cause one. I mean, certainly if there were evidence that, how do you say that word, exculpatory evidence?
Well, and Trump and the GOP are doing what they often do, which is making arguments that are persuasive to the 41% that I wouldn't think would have a lot of resonance outside the 41%.
Well, but actually, I don't think it's 41%. I think it's persuasive to like 30%. And in that, the difference between those two things is the key, kind of.
No, I guess I think I disagree with Micah that we're going to see as much shift among voters unless you start seeing more people in Congress, particularly the Republican. I mean, Elise Stefanik, she's been such a strong defender of the president to an extent that I wasn't really expecting going in, and they've just towed the party line. And so I think increasingly you're going to see more. It just, the numbers started to level off before the hearings started. I think it's going to be incredibly hard to nudge those numbers upwards.
Totally fair point. And Sarah points to an interesting dynamic, which is there's kind of a chicken or egg question with regards to public opinion, which is how much can public opinion on the right move against Trump if Republican elected officials, you know, Republican elites don't move against Trump? There's a perfectly reasonable theory that says it just can't move that much. As long as elected officials are standing by Trump, then the public will too.
Well, and then the other piece of that is, are Republican elected officials standing by Trump because the public hasn't moved that
exactly.
much?
Exactly. So chicken or egg. But look, I think like Sarah's absolutely right that like Trump's approval ratings judged against past presidents have been really steady. All the evidence we have suggests partisanship is really strong. Things are really hard to move. But, you know, if Trump's approval rating got to 37%, 36%, and it's been there before, it was there in his first year, so it's not like we're trying to imagine something we've never seen before, that's a really, really big deal and a big change from where we are now.
We will see what happens. And as we mentioned, we're going to be tracking impeachment hearings all week. We'll also have a reaction to the Democratic debate. So listeners, check in with us daily. But let's move on to the latest public opinion news out of Iowa. So here's a story. The Des Moines Register released a new poll of the Democratic primary race in Iowa this weekend. It shows Pete Buttigieg leading the pack with 25% support, followed by Warren with 16%, and Biden and Sanders each with 15%. In fifth place was Amy Klobuchar with 6%. So this is a significant shakeup from the last Des Moines Register poll in September, when Warren was leading the pack with 22% support. First of all, Nate, we tell listeners all the time not to put too much stock in a single poll. What is the argument for keying in on the results of this poll?
I don't think we're keying in on it. I think we're using it as an excuse to introduce a segment about Pete Buttigieg, who is an important candidate in this race. If you are going to key in on one poll, this is an A-plus rated poll done by Seltzer & Co. in Iowa. There have been other polls, though, also of Iowa, that give you some version of the same story, that show Buttigieg rising in Iowa, if not to first place, then kind of in a tie for first-ish. They show Bernie holding his own, if not having improved a little bit. And they show Biden, and particularly Warren, kind of declining. So you have a bunch of candidates who are bunched up together. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% of those, it seems like Biden is somewhere in the middle. Buttigieg is somewhere on top of that 20%. Warren, middle top, and Bernie is on the bottom, usually more around 15. But it's obviously a very competitive four-way race there right now.
Sarah, Buttigieg's support was at 9% in September, just 2 months ago. What is the explanation for his 16-point or so rise in Iowa?
Yeah, so I have two data points to help me make my case, and then I think one kind of squishy, bigger, big narrative explanation. I think for starters, he did really well in the last debate. This was something we immediately captured in our poll with Ipsos. He outperformed his pre-debate favorability. He did not get the top marks. Warren actually did, but he still got the third highest grade. But then if you take a bigger chunk of time out, he actually got the biggest increase, 4.5 points, in polls after this last debate in October, whereas Warren actually dropped a little. And this is in some polls that we've looked at prior to the October debate and then after. And I think while he has not increased as much nationally as he has in the early states, this isn't a new trend, him doing well in Iowa or New Hampshire. In their own write-up of that poll, the Des Moines Register noted that this top tier of Biden, Warren, Sanders, and Buttigieg really started to emerge in June. So I think it's like we're reaching a new point of momentum, but this has been in the wings building for a while now.
I mean, I think there are basically three theories here.
All right.
And Claire is not here to like give me side eye for talking too long, so one of you will have to instead.
I'll be happy to.
I think theory number one is that this all has to do with Iowa in particular, that Buttigieg is a good Iowa candidate. He's a, you know, nice Midwestern boy, has spent a lot of time and money there, has parlayed a lot of his early fundraising success into building out a ground game there, and that this is about Iowa leading the pack. It's theory one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Theory two is that this is more about the relative way the candidates are positioning themselves, that Buttigieg is pretty clearly attacking Warren now from the right, and is kind of correct to do so tactically because voters are not as liberal as some candidates were assuming, that Bernie is big competition on the left and therefore kind of putting a squeeze on Warren, where she on the one hand gets flack from Bernie supporters on her left and now also Buttigieg in the kind of center left, and she gets squeezed, and that's the dynamic. And the third theory is that this is a little bit of a media-inspired, infused bubble, right? Where, because, you know, in our initial polling after the debate, we did so show Buttigieg doing well, but, like, you know, if you looked at all polls conducted a week after last month's debate, then he got maybe a point rise, and Warren fell by maybe a point. Bernie rose by maybe a point. Klobuchar rose by maybe a point. These are small moves, right? But then they trigger press coverage. It's saying, hey, look, you know, let's notice how well Buttigieg is doing. And so that can kind of be a little bit of a self-fulfilling right. prophecy sometimes, where, and kind of you also happened at this time when the narrative was like, oh, we need kind of a new twist and turn in the story. And also at a time when I think Democratic donors, some party elites were saying, oh, I'm not sure. We're not really sure about the current top 2 to 4 candidates, although I don't think they particularly like Buttigieg either. The donors do, but I'm not sure like the
right.
party bigwigs do. But like, so there are a lot of things going on there.
So just a question based on everything you said, Nate. So one of those was specifically about Iowa, but the rest aren't necessarily. So Micah, why are we seeing this happen in Iowa, but not nearly to the same extent nationally?
Well, we're seeing a little bit of it in New Hampshire, too. Buttigieg has gotten some good polling there. But look, Buttigieg's support is still mostly white. So once you get to national surveys, he's not going to do as well there, at least yet, because those polls are more representative of the Democratic electorate overall, right? I think there's enough evidence to say that Buttigieg's, I don't know if you would call it a pivot to the center. Maybe that.
It's also a stylistical pivot to the center.
Yeah, whether it's on style or substance or just how he's positioned himself vis-a-vis Warren, I think there's enough evidence to say that has worked for him. Not only has he risen in the polls, but if you look at like who he does well with, what type of Democrats, it's much more Democrats who identify as moderates, Democrats who identify as somewhat liberal, while before he did better with the more liberal end of that spectrum. The problem with describing any of this, though, is like, you know when you're like walking down a hallway and someone's coming the other way and you both try to dodge each other the same direction at first, then you spend like 5 minutes both trying to make the same move and eventually it just somehow breaks and you walk past each other? The Democratic primary, because voters are so concerned about beating Trump and therefore have to make assumptions and guesses about what other voters will do, it's like that hallway scene times a million, right? Because they're all sort of like trying to guess, okay, what will voters in these other states do based on what I'll do, based on what the media is saying? And so you end up with this really complicated system that, like Nate says, has feedback loops and has, you know, it's just hard to describe. So like Buttigieg is rising. What can we point to? Maybe he did well in the debate, but maybe it was like 1,000 little things that broke his way, you know?
Well, the other thing to just note here is that the Democratic primary race and in general primary races can often be fluid because people don't have to jump across the partisan barrier in order to support a different candidate. They're already all Democrats,
right?
And all of these candidates are Democrats. So you can change your mind pretty quickly based on how the media is reporting on something or a new policy or whatever it may be. But based on what Micah said, Sarah, what are some of the challenges that face Buttigieg on the national scale?
Bootmentum.
Right. I mean, to some extent, I think he suffers the same problems Warren does, but on a much bigger scale, right? She also is struggling to diversify her base, but she still enjoys higher national support than Buttigieg does. So he really has to overcome how white his base is. When we were looking at polls in October and the crosstabs there, nationally, he enjoyed 2% Black support and 3% Hispanic support. Granted, Warren was not that much better off. She was around 13% among Black voters and 18% among Hispanic. Biden, to be clear, still really leads in this category. But it's a real problem for his candidacy, particularly with the issues that he's had as mayor in South Bend with the police force there and how that has turned off both members at home in his community, but also on the national level. And then I know we've talked about it before on the podcast and elsewhere on the site, but the fact that he is running as a openly gay man in the U.S. has real we haven't had a gay president, right? And so even though
openly gay president. That's debated whether or not we've had a gay president.
Sure, let's
not
get into that. You're right. Fair. But we've made strides. I think, since 2007, it was 50% of Americans open to the idea of a gay president. And now it's 76%, including a majority of Republicans. But that's still, there's pockets within that, particularly among voters who are lower educated, which is already a group that Buttigieg is struggling to build a base with. And I think that will also be a real issue for him moving forward. And, to the same extent that maybe Buttigieg has benefited from Warren being seen as too liberal, I think he could run a risk of maybe that flip-flop backfiring on him, where it's you're pivoting towards the center, as Micah said, but maybe that's a little bit too of a political maneuver, and that alienates voters in the end too, because it's not clear what he stands for other than an opposition to some of the more liberal policies that Warren or Sanders are putting forward in the field.
Well, what is interesting is the Buttigieg campaign leaked. I think it was them who leaked.
It was made public. We can assume that it was possibly leaked, or who knows what else happened. But it was made public.
This left in a Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah, exactly. This focus group that purported to show sort of resistance to Buttigieg among Black voters because of his sexuality. Right.
I have a quote from that.
Yeah.
And this is a focus group of Black voters in South Carolina. It says, quote, "Being gay was a barrier for these voters, particularly for the men who seemed deeply uncomfortable even discussing it. Their preference is for his sexuality not to be front and center." Also, let's say here, focus groups are not polling. They are not representative.
Right. So that's absolutely true. There is certainly less support for same-sex marriage, for example, in the Black community than there is among Democrats overall. Right. But I don't know, Buttigieg he's still not doing well with most groups of voters. So it's hard to pin it on that one thing. Certainly, maybe the campaign wants to blame it on that.
Well, the campaign also said, we don't think that's the reason that we're not doing well with Black voters. After this blew up a little bit and they were like, let's clarify. We think the reason that they're not supporting him is because they don't know him.
The part that's really interesting to me, though, is on the question of whether Buttigieg can get more support among Black voters is actually more an ideological question. This is something we've talked about on the podcast before, of this question of Black voters identify as more moderate. What does that mean? Because you could say, okay, well, Buttigieg is running more towards the center now. Maybe that will help him among Black voters. He doesn't have anywhere the connections to that community that Biden has. And we haven't seen any evidence yet that a pivot to the center has helped him there. But it'll just be interesting to watch, because according to one theory, you would think that would help him. I'm not sure I buy that theory, but,
The fact is that – let me back up a second, right? If you look at public opinion on same-sex marriage – among all voters in different racial ethnic groups, the differences have closed quite a bit, where Black voters are a little bit more opposed to gay marriage than white or Hispanic or Asian voters, but those differences have closed. If, however, you look at opinion among Democrats, you do see some fairly stark contrasts. So in 2016, 14% of white voters who voted in the Democratic primary opposed gay marriage, as did 22% of Hispanic voters, 19% of Asian voters, 20% of Native American voters. 41% of Black voters in the Democratic primary opposed gay marriage, which is a minority, but a much more sizable minority than 14 or 15 or 20 or 22. So what's going on here? Well, for most racial groups, if you're anti-gay, or maybe anti-gay is too strong a way to put it, right? But if you're not progressive on social issues, including gay rights, then you tend to be a Republican or an independent, or at the very least, you're not going to be excited to vote for a candidate in the primary, right? Because African Americans are so strongly Democratic, that socially conservative Blacks are also usually Democrats and often will vote in the Democratic primary, right? Therefore, there kind of is like a more of a challenge for Buttigieg. But like you said, I think it's not the only one, right? I think one thing, generally speaking, African-American voters tend to prefer candidates who have good credentials. They tend to prize electability. They tend to want to build alliances with candidates of other groups of support so their candidate can win, right? That kind of describes some of the support for Biden or Hillary Clinton before him. And Buttigieg does not have that experience, does not have that those connections, does not particularly come across as electable if you ask people who you think the most electable candidates are, right? And so irrespective of his sexuality, you would think he would not be a fantastic candidate in the African-American community, and irrespective of policing issues in South Bend. So he has multiple challenges, I think.
One thing that stood out to me, though, in that Seltzer poll was Buttigieg actually got the highest percentage among voters who thought he had the ability to beat Trump. He got 29% support, whereas Biden came in second with 17%. I can't think of many other polls where that has happened. And again, one poll, but I thought that was really interesting in the crosstabs of that one.
I want to get into a little bit more about what the Iowa poll tells us. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Legacy Box. Home movies can transport us back to unforgettable times. But when was the last time you watched yours? Legacy Box is simply the best way to convert all of your old analog media to DVD, thumb drive, or even convenient digital download so you can easily share with other members of your family. Plus, the process from start to finish is so easy. You just go online, purchase the box you need, they send you a Legacy Box kit, and you fill them with all of your media. Then you slap on a prepaid mailing label and send it back. Over 700,000 families have trusted Legacy Box. Legacy Box has been in business for over a decade and is the industry leader in professionally digitizing family memories. If memory is the diary you carry, let Legacy Box be the fresh ink. Get started preserving your past today. Go to legacybox.com/538 to get 40% off your first order. Save your time and memories. Go to legacybox.com/538 and save 40%. That's legacybox.com/538. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Hims. 66% of men start to lose their hair by age 35. And once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. 4hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. No snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements, just prescription solutions backed by science. Answer a few quick questions, a doctor will review, and if they determine it's right for you, can prescribe you medication to treat hair loss that is shipped directly to your door. Order now. Listeners can get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 today while supplies last and subject to doctor's approval. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy somewhere else. Go to 4hims.com/538. That's 4hims.com/538. 4hims.com/538. All right, we're back, and we talked plenty about Buttigieg. I'm sure we're going to talk about his campaign plenty more in the days, weeks, etc. to come. But there was something else that obviously happened in the Iowa poll that we wanted to key in on, which is that Warren declined from 22% support in September, leading the pack now to 16%, closer to where Biden and Sanders are. What is the explanation for that? Is it just media cycles again?
I think that explains part of it. Certainly, she went through a kind of rougher media cycle and got a lot of criticism for her positioning on healthcare.
By the way, do you regret? I kind of regret like not, because I think we did this more than a lot of people, right? But I regret like not being like even more emphatic about like the, hey, just because someone is rising today doesn't mean they'll rise tomorrow, and inevitably she's going to get like.
We were very clear about that. I feel like we pushed back on the co-frontrunner narrative stuff.
Oh, we were way bought into co-frontrunner. I think we bought into push back on sole frontrunner, Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, but you're saying
I was very bullish on co-frontrunner.
Oh, I
think they still probably are. It's just everyone's kind of caught up a bit. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, maybe we could have pushed back harder on that. But why is Warren going down? Frankly, I think part of it is electability became a bigger part of the conversation. I mean, maybe that's just another way of saying that she had a rough media cycle. But electability became a bigger part of the conversation. Some of that polling in Iowa shows concerns about her ability to win a general election for being too far left have increased there. And so as that happened, I think you saw some of her support go to Buttigieg, a little bit go to Sanders. And it's just a harder argument for her to make. Now, she's tried to, in the last couple of days even, she's tried to thread the needle on healthcare, where now she's proposing essentially a kind of a two-step plan, public option, and then Medicare for all. But it's, I don't know if it'll work, you know.
That plan that Warren released last Friday, it was what she called her transition plan on healthcare, and it laid out all these different things that she wanted to do, but the main takeaways vis-a-vis Medicare for All was that she says in the first 100 days she wants to pass a public option, and then up to 3 years into her hypothetical first term, she would try to tackle Medicare for All as a replacement for private insurance. Sarah, what's the political strategy there?
I think the reason why she has been so hesitant to really have a comprehensive health care plan is she knows on one level that Medicare for All, or at least this idea of abolishing private health insurance, isn't that popular even among Democrats. So I think what you're seeing in that is kind of a hedge for that bit, right? And I think, you know, one thing too in terms of her decline is after the health scare in early October for Sanders, he came back and had a strong debate performance. And I think you've seen that reflected a little bit in his polls as well, right? Like he gained in that Seltzer poll. I believe it was 4 points from September. He's also done a little bit better nationally. And as Micah was saying, you know, if people are starting to say she's too liberal, but then still want the real deal of Sanders, who's not backing down from Medicare for All, I think you're going to see, right, like a little loss of support there. And now she's trying to, I think, maybe compete with Buttigieg more than she once was on this idea of not calling it, you know, Medicare for all who want it. But it is kind of tampering down what I think she was initially pushing forward. And I think some of that is in response to the attack she was under in the last debate when she was really, as you know, we were talking about earlier, kind of the co-front runner on the stage at that point, was going to receive more scrutiny.
Yeah. If you want to paint an optimistic case for Warren, and then what you would say is, hey, she still has probably the best favorable ratings in the Democratic field. She's a lot of people's second choice, but because she kind of is this bridge between the left on the one hand and more mainstream Democrats on the other hand, then like, okay, in her worst moments, and she's going to say, have people, she's going to lose both those battles. She'll have Bernie be the preference of people on the left, and she'll have Buttigieg or Biden or someone else, right, be the preference of more mainstream Democrats. She, however, I think does have a big problem on healthcare.
Why do you think that?
Because it's a giant freaking problem for her. I mean, like,
well, no, but so what are the contours of that exact problem? Like, and why does this not solve it?
Well, it remains to be seen if it'll solve it or not. So, I mean, I think the original sin here, somehow Bernie Sanders, like the single smartest thing that anyone's done in the campaign is Bernie Sanders somehow getting like several other Democrats, including Kamala Harris, who's now has her own plan, and Elizabeth Warren to sign on to his version of Medicare for All, because it's kind of like a unwinnable position that you're in. You know, I think if Warren had not done that, then I mean, there are various steps that are in between Sanders' Medicare for All and just a public option, right? Kind of cases where everyone signed up, but you can opt out is one version of it. I think Beto had that plan, for example. But like, but so on the one hand, like the public option is more popular than Medicare for All, even among Democrats. On the other hand, for Bernie, he at least gets leadership. I mean, literally every other Democrat is like copying his plan at first, right? So he gets credit for that and being consistent.
Warren, if that was your number one issue, you would have just supported him probably anyway.
Right. And Warren kind of gets neither the popular position nor the leadership credit. And I don't know. I mean, I really want to see how she addresses it in the debate. I thought this statement she put out on Friday, and she put it out during impeachment hearings on Friday, which would suggest that, you know, it feels like something you kind of have to do, but you're not happy about it. I think this is a pretty big hedge. She was saying, here is a very detailed list of ways that I will affect the system without Medicare for All, and a detailed kind of basically public option plan that I will implement my first year. And then in my third year, I'll still fight for M4A, right? The thing is, in your third year, usually parties lose seats at the midterms. There are exceptions that come around kind of once a generation, but not very often. And so like, so Michael,
I totally don't get this criticism. So we'll see if it works or not. I think if Warren had from the beginning come out with a plan like this, I think it probably would have worked. It's totally political. Like, it's like you're stuck between a rock and a hard place, right? You're trying to win the left of the Democratic Party, which is gung-ho for Medicare for All, But Medicare for All overall, as Sarah was saying, is unpopular, right? So there's no way to perfectly square that circle. Some type of two-step whatever, right, is as good an attempt at squaring that circle as I've seen. But the criticism that, like, I think this is what you're saying, Nate, and I've seen other people make it, that, like, this imagines a world in which you'd be able to pass two major healthcare bills in one term, which has never been done before. Medicare for All is not going to become law. So is Warren's plan any less politically feasible than Sanders' plan, or frankly than like Biden's plan? I don't think so. All of this is like made up, right? None of this is going to happen.
Right. But why is she?
Right. But it's a litmus test, right? And now she's backing away from it, saying, well, I mean, to some level, I think it's communicating pretty strongly, like, hey, I'm in it to win this thing. Because as you're saying, right, like Sanders' plan isn't going to be passed into law, but she's still backing away. She's not, you know, Obama did a lot of things that weren't passed into law, but he didn't back down from it on the campaign trail. So I just think it is an interesting thing to thread if, like, part of your pitch to voters is I have a plan for that. And then it's, oh, actually, wait, the plan in which I have is kind of scaling down what I originally promised to kind of thread this middle ground. I just think that inevitably hurts you as a candidate if you came out initially saying I'm all for Medicare for All.
And the timing of it, because it wouldn't have surprised me if, let's say, she wins a nomination, she comes out and she's like, yeah, you're right. We might not get Medicare for All. So here's my public option plan, right? Or if she's disposed of some of her rivals and she's just trying to kind of hedge a little bit and kind of set up the general election.
I've listened to the American people and I'm incorporating their feedback.
Well, but what she's reacting to, though, is electability concerns by the Democratic Party, right? Like, I think that, yes, that is your traditional thing that happens.
I think it's literally that in the Iowa poll, 38% of Iowa Democratic caucus goers thought Warren is too liberal, up from 23% in March. And these are a liberal group. Only 4% say she's too conservative. These are one of the most liberal electorates that you'll encounter in the country, right? So it might be a combination of, people tied together electability and where you stand on the issues. Some people also just, frankly, like prefer the public option to Medicare for All. They believe some of the criticisms that Biden and others have. And also, I do wonder if Warren is like, I think Warren's rise came during a period where she was seen as like, she's this like kind of smart, affable wonk who, sure, she's liberal, quite liberal, but she's also pragmatic and has lots of plans for things, right? And so you don't have to be a leftist to like Elizabeth Warren. Somehow when she kind of reached this front runner status, people started perceiving her differently. And this includes like people, you know, that are quoted in the Times or the Post about, you know, Democratic donors fear. I mean, if you listen to like people in like the business community, I mean, for some reason, they've decided that Warren is not a more moderate alternative to Sanders, but a big threat to like, you know, kind of being a billionaire or a financier's way of life. And you might think people are like, oh, it's great when she's criticized by these jerks on CNBC or whatever, right? I do wonder if it does cause some problems, though. If you kind of consistently hear as a voter that Warren is too liberal, too liberal, too liberal, then for various reasons, Democrats might fear that. And also things like, you know, maybe there's a universe. I guess now with hindsight, we say it would never have happened, right? Maybe there was a universe where once she kind of catches Biden, that actually a little bit like with Howard Dean, which is not an example that ended well for the candidate in question, right? But like Howard Dean at one point led the Democratic primary in endorsements. And people were like, well, you know what? Clearly, this is what the people want. And he's not that bad. So if you're a party elite who thinks he's too liberal, you're like, he's not that bad. So, you know, I mean, Al Gore endorsed Howard Dean at one point, right? So we never quite saw that with Warren. We never quite saw people saying, you know what? Actually, let's work with her. We, again, speaking as a member of the establishment, we like her better than Bernie. And maybe we prefer Biden, but we're not sure if Biden can beat Trump anyway because he's lost his fastball. Therefore, you know, and you didn't see that.
I think I buy most of that. And there's a very compelling argument that the Warren campaign messed this healthcare issue up from the beginning and that they should have positioned themselves more as, hey, most of what Sanders is giving you, but more acceptable to the establishment. And so if you're playing that up a little bit more from the beginning, which would probably mean releasing something like this Medicare for All plan from the get-go, right? A public option, then we'll work towards Medicare for All. there's real risk there. The risk there is that Warren doesn't have that steady upward slope with the most liberal Democratic voters that we saw for months and months and months. But the potential upside is what Nate is describing, which is, okay, all of a sudden you get some endorsements. You don't lose this ground to Buttigieg. I would just say, though, that like in this counterfactual world, I think there are many simulations, if this is all a simulation, where Warren gets tagged more as just a political operator and a Clinton redux. And I think that's more that would have been more likely to happen if Warren had not run so cleanly to the left. You know, Claire had this great piece about Buttigieg on the site, and she interviewed a woman, and one of the quotes from the woman in the piece was, "Oh, I really like Warren." I'm paraphrasing. "I really like Warren, but every time I see her speak, I want to slap her." And it's like, wait, what? So I just think that like gender is never far from the surface here. And I think if she had not run so cleanly to the left, maybe would have tripped up this rise of hers a little more. And frankly, maybe is part of what's tripping her up now, you know.
And also, I mean, I think that Warren's defense on a lot of this is going to be something along the lines of, from the beginning, I said that the two main things that I wanted to tackle were the wealth tax and corruption. And so she always said that healthcare was not her number one priority in the way that it was for Sanders. But I want to give us some time to move on and actually answer a listener question from last week. So last Monday, when we had two Nates on the podcast, we talked a lot about the role that education plays in determining how people vote and how it's important to wait for education when you're polling. And that basically means like make sure that you have a representative number of people with and without college degrees in your final results. And so we got a question from a listener, Katrina, who asked just basically, why does education matter so much in how people vote? And this is something that we want to do more reporting on here at 538, because we do think it is a worthwhile and interesting question. And we're going to brainstorm ways to answer that in a meaningful way. But because it's such a good question, we wanted to just take a little bit of time to talk about what we do know about the answer to that question. And then we'll follow up on it later when we do some more in-depth reporting. So, Sarah, I know this is something that you have looked into. Why is education such an important factor in determining how people vote?
Increasingly, education is a new proxy for class. But the reason why we're talking about it so much and why it's so important in determining how someone will vote is because that was the number one indicator in 2016 for whether you voted for Trump or Clinton. And, you know, education, it's often correlated with income. But even when you isolated for education levels in 16, it was the key driver. Counties with the largest populations of those without a college degree broke for Trump. And I think, you know, because this is a pretty big realignment between the parties, non-college educated white voters used to solidly be Democratic voters, and that has shifted so dramatically is another reason in which we're talking about this. And, you know, in less than a decade, you're talking from 2010 to 2018, whites without a college degree grow from 50 to nearly 60% of the Republican Party. Meanwhile, whites with a college degree fall from 40 to 29%. I mean, that's a huge shift. But I think two things can get lost in this. And one is that it's not just among poor, non-college educated whites for whom this is true. And also Democrats, and you talked about this on the podcast last week, they're also losing, though, among minority voters without a college degree, although we know less about that. And the narrative there, I think, is a bit more complicated. But on that first point, you know, there's this overarching narrative that I think is a bit simplistic that, you know, the GOP is dependent on the white working class. Not untrue, but also there's a surge among whites in the Republican Party with like relatively high incomes, like 70,000 to 130,000. So middle class that are also breaking for the GOP. Earlier in August, Thomas Edsel had a piece for the Times on this. And I thought that, you know, he was citing the different research that shows again that it's not income indicating where people are going to break, but education. And that's true of people making under 50,000 and then over 70,000. So people you wouldn't necessarily think of as white working class are also breaking for Trump. But then again, you know, as you all touched on last week, that even when you start to drill in among voters who aren't white, but also don't have a college degree, you're starting to see shifts among that as well, away from Democrats. That was something we saw in 2016. But across the board, it seems as if, yes, education is increasingly a dividing line between the two parties, and it cuts across all sorts of different demographics.
So, Nate, what is it specifically about having a college degree or not having a college degree that determines how you vote? Like, is it the simple act of going to college makes you a liberal?
I mean, I think there are, it's another kind of three theory.
I want to hear all three.
You want a three theory? Yeah. So one is that education is just a marker of class. What's that mean? I don't know, because class is a very complicated concept, right? But, you know, it has to do with your social status. It has to do with how much esteem you generate, the prestige of the jobs that you're able to obtain, who your peer networks are, right? So that's one idea. Another idea is has to do with, like, the community that you're embedded in. This is related to class, obviously, but may actually be the fact of going to college and meeting different types of people and then keeping some of those bonds and relationships later on in life, right? Because, you know, in addition to education, then geography now has become a very powerful predictor of who you vote for, in the sense of, like, if you live in a neighborhood, you can actually go to, like, we should publish this research. You should go to, like,
you were supposed to file it like a year ago.
I know, it's still on the still on Trello. If you actually go and say, okay, I'm going to look up your census block, your census tract, and figure out how many people live in a 5 mile square radius, not square, circular radius around you, then that's a very powerful predictor of who you vote for, predictor of who you vote for. And also, if you look at, like, where is my community, where is my home relative to the overall community? Do I actually, like, live in the center of town or on the outskirts? It actually also predicts Democratic voting quite a bit. So it's number one, class. Number two, community. The third explanation is the one that probably, like, liberals would like, and I think it's probably the least persuasive of the three, which is that it's about being informed. Right. And then if you're well educated, then you're informed, and, you know, kind of the Paul Krugman argument, like the facts would have a liberal bias. And so that would push you toward being more persuaded about certain Democratic arguments. I'm not saying there's nothing at all in that, but, like, but, you know, there's lots of research showing that people can be very well educated and very informed and still very partisan, and the partisanship can override that. But I think those are the three ideas that occur to me offhand, at least.
So where would race and racial resentment fit in there? Because there is some research that shows, okay, so the Democratic Party used to have a lot of non-college educated whites in it, right? It was the party of unions and so on. So actually, I think that is one potential explanation for why education has become such a dividing line, is like the kind of demise of unions over time. But anyway, Michael Tesler, who's a political scientist, what his research found, and other research has showed this, is basically that non-college whites started moving out of the Democratic Party and into the Republican Party, beginning basically when the Democratic Party became identified with civil rights, right? When the Democratic Party started to sort of become identified with, hey, we're the party for protecting and empowering and helping minority communities, right? That goes on for decades and decades and decades. Then when Obama is elected, essentially that idea that the Democratic Party is the party for, whatever that means, quote unquote, for non-white Americans, that Obama's election, the election of a black man, essentially broadcasts that in marquee lights to the world. And therefore, even low information voters, let's say including non-college educated voters, voters who aren't really paying that much attention to politics and therefore aren't picking up on, like, more subtle cues that the Democratic Party is more aligned with minority community interests, Obama's election gets to them, right? And since Obama's election, you see that movement, non-college educated whites towards the Republicans and college-educated whites towards Democrats, supercharged, right? Mm-hmm. And what Tesler found in his research is essentially once you control for variables about attitude, variables about, like, how much racial resentment you show, or, like, questions like,
are white people discriminated against at the same rates as other
exactly.
races?
Or even questions like, do you think America was better off, you know,
in
however
the 50s
many
and 60s.
Yeah, than it is now, which, like, make America great again, right? That's what that's getting at. Mm-hmm. What he found, at least, is that once you control for that stuff, education as an explanatory variable sort of disappears. That's just one piece of research. So,
Also, it would seem like those are somewhat related. Like, oftentimes, college-educated people learn some of their cultural and racial attitudes
right.
through the higher education system. I mean, just to add to this, and like I said, we're going to do more reporting on this, so we will come back to this. In reading a bit over the weekend, one interesting thing that I saw is that actually, so women have for a long time preferred Democrats over Republicans, and women now outnumber men in higher ed. So actually, the college-educated population in America has become skewed more towards women than it once was. And so that already tracks with women preferring Democrats over Republicans.
Yeah, I tend to be disposed toward these kind of community-type arguments because it is interesting that, like, so the Democratic Party consists of a combination of largely upscale whites and then Black, Hispanic, and Asian voters of different social classes, although predominantly in the U.S. that if you're Black or Hispanic, you're more likely to be poor than if you're white or if you're Asian. And, you know, arguably those groups would not have, like, that much in common necessarily. But, you know, through kind of colleges, because colleges do try to be diverse places, and through cities where, because cities also tend to have Black, Hispanic, and well-off whites, and actually not that many poor whites often in cities. So, like, kind of this overlap between college and community and kind of the coalition of the Democratic Party all kind of have interesting overlaps. And if you're not a part of that, if you're on the outside looking in, then you might feel like you're a Republican. Although there is research also suggesting that, like, that, you know, non-college African-Americans, especially men, and Hispanics are an interesting swing group where there is a little bit maybe of sympathy to Trump. I think that was in Nate Cohen's research at the Upshot he was talking about
before.
Yeah,
so right? I mentioned that as
not
well.
Not a lot. I mean, you know, the Democratic nominee is going to get 89 or 90 or 91% of the Black vote. But if they get 89 or 90 instead of 93 or 94, then that's actually pretty material. And it seems like young, non-college, African-American, and Hispanic men are groups that are at least worth watching.
Yeah. Well, great question from Katrina. We appreciate all listener questions. So if you listen to the podcast, have things you want to ask us, follow up on, feel free, podcast@538.com or Twitter. But let's leave it there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Micah.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcast@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.